Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in KHOI's seven-county listening area in central Iowa. This is Local Talk Wednesday. I am Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for today. Thank you for joining to listen in. It is my great pleasure to have two other KHOI hosts here with me.
Maggie Westfold.
And I'm Pat Schlarbaum. Well, today let's start off with our phrenology, focusing on one of our rich members of our birding community here in central Iowa. Let's learn about hummingbirds today. Phrenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur, the first prairie flower of spring or the last osprey of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's phrenology is about Iowa's hummingbirds. Hummingbirds are some of the most distinctive birds to see in Iowa, if your eyes can keep up. Known for their extremely speedy flight and abrupt stops, these winged gems are fun to spot and easy to attract to your yard or apartment windowsill with a feeder. Outdoor-loving individuals enjoy providing a mixture of sugar water to feeders specifically designed for hummingbirds. They can be purchased where bird feeders are sold. While Iowa most certainly has hummingbirds, there's debate as to how many species frequent the state from year to year. Part of the difficulty is getting the birds to sit still for a photo. And another part is that four of the five species ever documented in Iowa are exceedingly rare. The second most common, the rufous-sided hummingbird, has only been documented 14 times, and you could count the sightings of the least common three on one hand. But it's the ruby-throated hummingbirds, however, are common across all 99 counties, and more than 80% of the estimated 20 million ruby-throated hummingbirds in the world spend time in the U.S. every year. The ruby-throated hummingbird is a distinctively festive coloration and can be seen all summer. Both males and females are mostly iridescent emerald, with a patch on their chest and chin that's red in males and white or gray in the females. The fancy word for this patch is the gorget, as it looks similar to the armor plates that are covered the throats of medieval military personnel. Hummingbirds like food they can spot, and with eyes that can see into the ultraviolet spectrum, they can spot a lot. Ruby-throated hummingbirds prefer visiting red and orange flower, like our cannas and trumpet vines. For artificial feeders, the color of the feeder itself attracts the hummingbirds. Adding food dye to the sugar water in your feeder won't significantly impact the feeder's overall attractiveness to hummingbirds, so you can skip adding the food dye. Hummingbirds also supplement their nectar diet with protein and fat from insects. These birds commonly steal meals out of spider webs and prey on insects caught in tree sap. Hummingbird meals have been analyzed to contain gnats, beetles, aphids, spiders, mosquitoes, ants, and even bees, although those the birds eat tend to be exceedingly small. So if you see a hummingbird darting around an area, apparently doing nothing, it's likely eating insects too small for you to see. Hummingbirds like swifts are classified as apitiformes, literally meaning without feet. This is due to their very short legs and habit of tucking their feet in close to the body during flight. Hummingbirds' legs are so short that they are not capable of hopping or walking, although they can manage a shuffle and can scratch their heads with some acrobatics. Hummingbirds also lack down feathers, which would weigh them down and create more drag in flight. Unfortunately, this makes them more susceptible to weather changes, as they can't trap warm air around their bodies without the down. So the hummingbirds, instead of shivering, goes into a torpid state to conserve energy. In this state, the bird's body temperature plummets and its heartbeat can drop from as many as 1,200 beats per minute to just 50. This allows the hummingbird to survive freezing nights and warm up in the morning from sunlight. Artificial feeders can also be crucial in cold weather survival, but only if the sugar water in them doesn't freeze. Inexpensive hummingbird feeders can be purchased or made at home for those that don't have the time or the green thumb to create a garden with plants to attract hummingbirds. For best results, pick a red feeder and fill it with sugar water, a solution of 1/4 cup sugar to 1 cup of water. Mix well and change the solution often. If it gets cloudy, you waited too long and should fully clean out the feeder. Cloudiness indicates fermentation and the production of toxic alcohol, which can be very hazardous to hummingbirds. Each autumn, hummingbird feeders can attract hummers from near and far. Their population numbers are enhanced with young of the year, and the northern hummers will visit feeders along their migration corridors. Their aggressive nature at feeders creates amazing battles of hummingbird mayhem, which only enhances our appreciation of these lightweight flying dynamos. Lastly, when I was growing up, there was a myth that during migration, hummingbirds could hitch a ride on the backs of Canada geese. It seemed the only plausible explanation of hummingbirds traversing the Gulf of Mexico each spring and autumn. Although rich in romanticism that one species could benefit the needs of another, this myth has been debunked. Yet, it is another marvel of nature that these tiny birds that weigh as much as a nickel could provide such stamina for distant travels. And that's our phenology for ruby-throated hummingbirds for today.
Seals and Croft with Hummingbird, and you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you, Pat, for that segment on the hummingbird. Great way to start the day. Yesterday, after 7 years of Republicans vowing to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, the Senate took a first step in that direction. They voted to proceed with the debate on the GOP health care bill. Two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, broke ranks and opposed the motion to proceed. All other Republicans voted to proceed, including Iowa Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley. Democratic senators opposed the motion 48-0. Senator John McCain had been out on leave to battle brain cancer, but made a dramatic return to cast the necessary Republican vote along with Vice President Mike Pence, who issued the tie-breaking vote 51-50 to proceed with the debate over a Republican health care bill. Hours after the vote occurred to proceed with the debate, Republicans failed to pass the Senate's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. They needed 60 votes but fell short with 43 votes in favor and 57 opposed. Many saw this vote, well short of even 50 votes, was an ominous sign for Republican leaders still trying to pass final health care legislation this week. Senator McCain himself remarked that it seemed likely that the current repeal effort would end in failure. Before senators voted to start the debate in the afternoon, protesters in the Senate gallery were chanting, "Kill the bill, don't kill us," and "Shame, shame, shame." The debate in the Senate will have broad implications for health care and households in every state, and emotions are high. But for the moment, health care issues are being defined by language of government protocol and political strategies. So we asked Mike Owen, executive director of the Iowa Policy Project, to join us for a few minutes To help us clarify exactly what all this means to Iowans, Mike, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. If I understand things correctly, the Senate bill that was just voted down would have replaced the health bill that was adopted by the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. And since that failed to pass, what happens now is the Senate has decided to proceed with considering the original bill that the House of Representatives passed. Is that correct?
I've seen a couple of versions, to be quite honest. And, you know, the long and the short is they're having trouble getting anything passed. And so that will be the trick over the coming hours, days, and who knows, weeks, as to whether they can find something that they can actually get enough votes for now that they have the motion to proceed. That motion to proceed that passed Vice President's deciding vote kind of opens the gate for this whole thing to go on. Senator McCain thinks they'll have a lot of trouble getting something passed.
So the House bill that is basically what's being discussed or is on the table is not really expected to be the final piece of legislation. It's kind of a vehicle for lawmakers to begin putting ideas into it. Is that correct?
Yeah. And what could happen is this gets to a conference committee. You know, whatever passes in the Senate, it won't be identical to what passed in the House. It could then go to a conference committee where all this stuff is decided behind closed doors, which in some ways, I'm not trying to be cynical here, but probably be apropos of what we have seen so far in this whole process, because the House bill and then the Senate bill were both hatched behind closed doors and dumped in everybody's laps, and both carry tremendous implications for people who have insurance now because of the Affordable Care Act. People can agree or disagree with the idea that there even is an Affordable Care Act. The fact is that we have one, and it's insured, you know, millions of people across the country, and, you know, elements of it, such as the Medicaid expansion that was done in Iowa, has insured 150,000 people in the state of Iowa.
Can you explain what the Medicaid expansion was in Iowa? I know it was different in different states. What exactly happened in Iowa?
The main thing is that it raised the ceiling of income eligibility to get into the Medicaid program to 138%. That made Medicaid available to a lot more people than could get it before. On top of that, the Affordable Care Act also had subsidies through tax credits for people to buy insurance on the private market, which is the so-called exchange. Now, we've had problems with that in Iowa, clearly, because not all insurers are participating in the exchange, and currently it appears to be about one. So there are certainly issues with the exchange that need to be dealt with and could be dealt with both in Iowa or with larger healthcare legislation in Washington. That doesn't seem to be the emphasis right now. The emphasis seems to be on feeling anything that has President Obama's stamp on it, and who knows what we get for a replacement. But in all of these plans that we have seen, you're taking millions of people off insurance. You're making it harder for people to get insurance. You're raising the cost for those people. You're raising costs for providers. And all of this makes for a much more precarious situation for people's health. They can't get health care when they need it. Makes for a much more precarious situation for the economy, because health care is a big part of the economy.
As part of this process, Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and some other senators from states that had expanded have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act made a proposal, which, by the way, didn't pass, but nonetheless would add a $100 billion stability fund to help pay out-of-pocket medical costs for certain low-income people, including those buying private insurance after losing Medicaid coverage. And he kind of expressed this as an offer for a soft landing for people who had been benefiting from Medicaid. Can you speak to that, the viability of that?
The analysis that I have seen of that amendment is that it would not have done anywhere near what current law does to extend coverage to people. It was simply a move to get more votes for the bill, where they're having trouble getting to that 50 for any plan so that they can then use the vice president to get to 51. So anything that was just one device, the Portman plan.
So you're saying that was more of a political maneuver?
Well, I would say it was a serious political attempt to get what their vision of health care is.
Uh-huh.
We're trying to repeal Obamacare. It certainly would not have done what current law does for insurance. You would still have had a lot more people without insurance and unable to afford insurance.
Another proposal that was put on the table was by Ted Cruz, which was what he called the consumer freedom option, which would have allowed insurance companies to offer kind of a bare bones plan as long as they also offered insurance plans that included the Affordable Care Act coverage, such as maternity care or substance abuse treatment. So those would be some cheaper options for younger, healthier people. That also did not pass. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, the biggest flaw with the Cruz Amendment is that it would really undermine the concept of covering people with pre-existing conditions and several other elements. There are essential coverages that are required now under the Affordable Care Act, and the Cruz Amendment was designed to strip those requirements away. And again, that makes it difficult for people with pre-existing conditions to get coverage and drives up the cost for those who can find it. The central part of that Cruz Amendment is that it takes away those essential elements of coverage.
And we're speaking with Mike Owen, Executive Director of the Iowa Policy Project, trying to clarify what's happening right now in Congress with the health care bill. And Mr. Owen, is the Affordable Care Act still in the law right now, or has it actually been repealed by the Senate?
No, the Senate has not repealed. And they would have to have agreement with the House to do it. They're trying to, but the Affordable Care Act is law. And I think one of the dangers of the current debate is that it's easy to compare, I shouldn't say it's easy, but we can compare the Senate moves this far past what they wanted to do before, or the House, but we get comparisons to other proposals. What we really need is a comparison to the current law, which insures more people than was the case many years ago. We'll go on into the future insuring more. And by 2019, we have about 177,000 Iowans who will have insurance if we keep the current law, just because of the Medicaid expansion. We lose that if the Medicaid expansion goes away. So maybe some of those folks can find insurance in another way, but if they can, it's going to be less comprehensive and it's going to cost them more.
Okay, thank you. I know it's difficult right now to have a longer conversation because actually none of us really know what's going to happen in the process. As far as I understand, that after 20 hours, the Senate will start what they call a votorama, and that's when any senator can introduce an unlimited amount of amendments. And the Democrats in the Senate plan to take full advantage of that by proposing amendments that won't pass but will buy time to allow further discussion and further contemplation on the whole issue. I read that Senator Chris Murph, Democrat of Connecticut, says he has 100 amendments that he's planning to offer starting today. So it sounds like the Democrats will make an effort to extend the debate as long as possible to give people time to think about this. And really, none of us know what's going to happen. So I'll kind of let you have the last word here. What do you think, as Iowans, it's important for us to kind of think about as we listen to the, you know, political process making its way through Congress?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we need better transparency on this whole process. The healthcare issue is incredibly complicated. And the idea that we're going through this process, like you mentioned, this votorama, things are going to be coming down the pike on this bill where people have no good ideas to the impact of it. And if there's anything we need more of, it's some deliberation, some diligence, some openness to the process. And that has not been the tenor of discussion or the characteristics of this debate since it's been going on. We get these proposals that are being hatched behind closed doors without sufficient information from nonpartisan analysts that work for the government and nonpartisan analysts that are in the nonprofit world, like organizations that we work with. People need information to make good decisions, and we're not getting that information. We're getting talking points and we're getting, you know, a lot of spin on Sunday morning television shows.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not getting a good sense as to what's going into the public policy that's going to directly affect the lives of all of us. That's what we need.
Do you have any suggestions where people can turn for finding their own information?
Yes, there are some very good organizations who are working on some of these things. You know, we do what we can at the state level at iowapolicyproject.org, but I would suggest cbpp.org, which is for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. These are very excellent analysts of budget issues, and they have experts on the healthcare issue that, in particular, that are helpful to people. And the Urban Institute also has some very good information, and the Kaiser Family Foundation. So all of those organizations have websites. I would encourage you, people, to Google for those. Again, Kaiser, the Urban Institute, and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Owen.
Thank you.
We really, really appreciate it. Thanks for stopping in and just helping us to kind of unpack what's happening right now to healthcare. And thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Blue in Green by Miles Davis. This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum, here with Ursula Rudenberg and Maggie Westfold. Yesterday, Ursula and Maggie went to a much-loved rural business in Story County, Slim's Country Market.
I have driven by that roadside market many times on Highway 69 by Story City, but I have to admit, I never stopped to check it out firsthand. Perhaps you've done that, too. Maggie was the one who took me there. While waiting for the owner, she showed me around the place, and we started at the store's gift room.
I'm leaning over these handmade soaps. My goodness, the fragrances. Cuckoo for coconut, orange creamsicle, razzle frazzle, milk and oats, morning glory. These are handmade in Iowa by Rachel Uttecht. This stuff smells wonderful. And she also has bath balm, lip balms. We have wooden signs for sale, ready to hang. Shabby chic stuff here. These are old windows with and without glass. You hang for decorative purposes. Half of an old barn door, decorator signs. Here's candles. This is quite attractive. An Ufta sign that has been rose mauled. Probably locally here. Ceramic cups for tea and coffee that have a lid. All right, we're going to walk out into another part of the shop. Apples, grapefruit, lemons, limes, oranges. Is that a whole quart of honey? Raw honey packed by Monick Honey Farms in Lehigh, Iowa. That's not too far away. I think it's better for you to eat honey from your area as far as allergies and such, so. And here's maple syrup from Prairie Farm, Wisconsin. Jalapeno mustard, classic barbecue sauce made for Slim's Country Market. And here's bulk popcorn for those who pop in a pan. That seems almost like a thing of the past. Canned products, preserved products, pickled okra, pickled garlic, sweet onion relish, watermelon pickles. Ooh, this stuff sounds good. Sweet onion relish.
And that was a taste of what's at Slim's Country Market on Highway 69 by Story City. Kurt Johnson is a man on the youngish side of middle age. He has owned the market now for 5 years. We asked him to tell us what it's like to own a countryside market, something he himself describes as a piece of Americana. We started out by pointing out a challenge he faced. During the first 5 years of his business, Highway 69 was often closed. 69 is, of course, the route to his store.
Do you see a big difference now that the highway's open?
Oh, for sure. This is our second full season with a totally open road. The first year we were open, they resurfaced the whole highway. It wasn't closed totally, but just one lane traffic. That lasted pretty much three quarters of the season. Last year they closed the bridge. The third year they closed the railroad tracks. So, boy, just the traffic on the road alone from people that live in Jewell that work in Ames, people that would travel from north to south would take interstate. But a lot of our real loyal customers still did come see us because, yeah, it's a destination point. People love going to Slim's.
Tell us why people love coming to Slim's.
Well, it's been here for 74 years. Quality produce, personal service. People like conversation. They come here to chat with you. You're not a number like you are in bigger box stores.
Can you tell us how far and wide you bring your products in from?
It's such a wide, different array of different things, different people that bring me stuff, like the popcorn, the Iowa popcorn. It just depends. I mean, I have a guy over in Marshalltown that I buy stuff from, green beans, asparagus. You know, it's kind of random. There's a lot of local people around. Keith Hovick brings me cucumbers or kohlrabi or beets, the tomatoes. There's a lady named Cindy Westrom and Mark in Stratford, and they grow a lot of my vegetables for me in the summer. We have local locker meats. We have, like you said, the soap. We have, well, Sweet Treats ice cream now, and there's a couple that started making cheese and Jewel.
I know you get people to sign up for Missouri peaches before they're ever here. What is it with Missouri peaches?
Oh.
My mother was from Missouri, and there is no peach like a Missouri peach, she
right,
said.
Right, yeah,
yeah, they are delicious.
Well, they call them bend over peaches. Right now, Missouri is, we're getting a lot of stuff from there right now besides the vegetables, the cantaloupes, Missouri watermelons, the peaches.
What carries the store the most?
As far as products, cantaloupes, watermelons, peaches, tomatoes. Four main items, watermelons, cantaloupes, tomatoes, and peaches. And sweet corn when they're in season.
What's your favorite thing to sell?
The product sells themselves. I don't do anything except for stand back and help people. I mean, my favorite thing to do is just talk to the people that come in. I just love talking to my customers.
Tammy Arneson.
Are you a regular customer?
Oh, yeah.
What do you like best about the service here?
It's just friendly. They have a ton of stuff. He has great tomatoes and cantaloupe. My mother-in-law loves the cantaloupe here. It's variety and super nice people that work here that run it. And everything he has is good. I'm delivering Kringla. I've been bringing Kringla here for about the last 6 years. It's like a Norwegian cookie.
And where do you make it?
At home. I have a home bakery.
And what? Tell us the name of your Kringla.
It's Made with Love Bakery from Ellsworth.
You're from Ellsworth, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
People buy Kringla?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Kurt is one of six stores that I take to.
Do you like working with Kurt?
Yeah. He's a great guy. He's just super nice and friendly. Yep.
Okay.
Everyone loves Kurt.
At this point, Mr. Paul Wirsen arrived at Slim's Country Market. Paul is, of course, a regular host on Local Talk Wednesdays. He lives near Story City, and he grew up in the area, so this was a perfect time to talk about the history behind Slim's Country Market, including two generations of men that people call Slim. Again, you're hearing an interview with Kurt Johnson, who is not one of the Slims, but he is now owner of the market, and you'll hear Paul joining the conversation here.
John's father, the original Slim, and his wife, they started one truckload of watermelons. They ended up selling out that truckload. They moved from Colo to here, and the rest is history.
All here. And this goes into my memory. I was born in 1943. I live on a farm just east of Slim's. So when I was growing up, Slim was well established.
The original Slim and his wife started it down at the Artesian in 1943.
It was a narrow curved highway. This was the main artery to Minneapolis at that time. It was a stopping off. There was an Artesian station there, named so because there was an Artesian flow.
Mm-hmm. Like a well?
Yeah, run by Bill Root.
When I was 7 to 10, Sunday afternoons, one of our fun trips was to come up here
And out of the car, we bailed to go have water out of that artesian. It was in the ditch.
Was it a pump or what
was
it?
It was a pipe sticking up out of the ditch, and you could have a drink of artesian.
Artesian water comes out from high pressure. And then Slim had his stand right by this artesian well, so people could stop and get this wonderful cold fresh water from deep in the earth. And then he had all these melons and all the things that you stock.
They moved up to this location in 63 because, like you were saying, the highway got too busy.
Right.
The DOT came and put stakes in the ground in front of their business every 5 feet so people could not pull into their parking lot. That was in 63. Then they moved up here to the corner.
They had their living quarters behind the stand. And all the children, and so all the kids grew up there too. So they were living in their business, and Slim was really slim. He was a thin guy with his fedora hat that was always turned down, and really quite a character in the area, because everybody loved Slim. He was a fair and honest businessman, which you had to be to do a stand like that. And really, Kurt, I think it's just terrific that you've revived this business here.
That's Paul Wearson and a little bit of myself discussing the origins of Story City's Slim's Country Market with its current owner, Kurt Johnson. Finally, we asked Kurt what it's like to run an old-fashioned country store in this day and age.
So what time do you start in the morning?
About 6:30.
What time do you end at night?
I get home about 8. So I've been in retail for 25 years. I was a produce manager at Hy-Vee in Ames. Hy-Vee was great to me, but I walked away and just wanted to do something different, and then this opportunity came about. Mm-hmm. When you're in the produce business, you run across each other in different places, and I've known of the stand. I've known Slim for 20 years. We've just been friends, so it just kind of worked for me. I could use all my produce contacts of growers and different brokers and bring them to this business.
So you went from a big grocery store to a tiny grocery store.
Right. You don't know how many times a day I hear, thank you for being here. And you know what? That makes my day. Mm-hmm. That really does. It's actually perfect. There's something to be said for making friends with your customers and knowing who they are and being able to help them. It's just really gratifying to know that I got you something that's quality, mm-hmm. something that you want. You know, something that wasn't pushed down your throat. Just on a daily basis, it's just really fun to interact with people. And you get to know them, you know, not just as customers, but you know about their family members and what's going on in their lives. And that's what makes it fun. That's why John, his dad was successful. That's why he was successful. And that's why we're doing it now, because people come here to see you. They say, I need a cantaloupe. And when are you going to use your cantaloupe? Today, tomorrow, this weekend? You get them one and you tell them exactly how to store it and keep it at their house. You know, you pick it out exactly. I want some peaches. Well, how many do you want that are ripe? How many do you want in 2 or 3 days? Now, you don't go to a grocery store in Ames and go down the produce aisle and say to one of the clerks, I need 10 peaches, but I need 4 of them I can use now and 6 of them that I can use in 2 days. Well, they're going to look at you like, that's why it's hard for anybody to just go open something like this, because you have to have the years and years of doing it to be able to do that.
Would you recommend somebody going into a small country grocery store like this? And if so, what advice would you give them?
Absolutely not, probably. It's one of those deals where it looks glorious from the outside, but like I tell my wife, if they had to, you would have a line of people that said they would want to do it and run it, but if they walked in your shoes for a week, starting something would be very difficult. The biggest trouble now with places like this is actually finding suppliers, growers. The folks that grow the products, they're getting older, they're retiring, the kids are not taking over. That's the biggest issue and worry moving forward is your suppliers.
A lot of people who are farming now, who are retiring and might be suppliers, their next generation may rent out the farm to someone else or not be involved in agriculture at all.
That's exactly why folks your age, come in and ask me, well, when are you going to get the muscatine melons in? Well, we haven't had a muscatine melon in 20 years. It's all corn and soybeans now. They might have enough for themselves over there, but, you know, the kids took over. They just don't do they, it's hard to raise watermelon and cantaloupe physically, yeah. You know, and the margins get smaller and smaller because your suppliers want more for their product. Obviously, if they have a quality product, you can't, there's only so much you can get for something. Is this day and age, this place would not be able to be open if I wasn't married and had my wife have her job with benefits and a supplemental income, just because, let's be honest, with all the competition you have now in Ames, it would be very hard with expenses the way they are to try to start a small business with no tradition behind it. The tradition here with 74 years, Slim being here before, different contacts, and my background.
It looks like a simple roadside grocery store, but actually this is a lot of experience, contacts, and tradition is what really makes this happen, right?
Exactly, exactly. And hard work.
So who are you going to pass the stand on to? You glad you did this?
For sure. I'd never do it any other way. There's nothing better than working for yourself and having great customers and talking to them every day. There just isn't. And let me tell you, it's the people in the community that make it fun. That's why you're here.
And that was a report from Slim's Country Market on Highway 69 by Story City. I'm one of your hosts, Maggie Westfold, and here with Ursula Rudenberg and Pat Schlarbaum. We began today's Local Talk Hour with a report on the tiny hummingbird. So, what better way to end the hour than with the mighty eagle? Pat?
Yes, after 10 years, the famous Decora eaglets have flown or fledged from their nests. Once again, all three were successful. We received the update on the workings of Bob Anderson's Raptor Resource Project from their new director, John Howe. Bob passed away in 2015, and in the process, we also learned of an exciting scholarship being created to benefit students interested in the environment. Our listeners may know a likely candidate or family member to carry on the mission of the Raptor Resource Project. Today with John Howe, the director of the Raptor Resource Project. Welcome to Local Talk.
Hey, Pat. Good to be here.
Yeah, so let's give some background to our listeners that the Raptor Resource Project was established by Bob Anderson, the famous Decora Eagle steward.
Right. As executive director of the Raptor Resource Project, I get to carry on and help tell the amazing story. What you alluded to was Bob's initial founding of the Raptor Resource Project, and that was really to help recovery of the peregrine falcon in the Midwest after the devastating effects of DDT and what it had on raptors. And part of that, his breeding and releasing and giving falcons out to the communities for repopulating, and then the other historic release of falcons off of Effigy Mounds, Hanging Rock area from the rock line nest boxes to help get them imprinted on going back to their historic pothole eyries on the bluffs of the Mississippi Rivers.
And that effort 20 years ago was successful.
And then
lo and behold, Bob relocated to Decorah, Iowa, as I understand, and then saw a nesting pair of bald eagles at the local fish hatchery.
Right.
And
right.
So here we are a number of years later, but then Bob's untimely passing in 2015 has kind of set the stage for you becoming the director. And,
right.
And I know you were very instrumental in a lot of the technology, capturing those famous images of those birds.
Right. Right about that time period, I remember early 2015, I talked Bob into helping purchase through the Raptor Resource Project the first HD camera that we could put out on our family's property north of La Crescent at Great Spirit Bluff. And we used it that first season to watch the peregrine falcons there. At that time, it was Michelle and Travis. raised there young, and beautiful views of the Mississippi River Valley there, Lake Onalaska, and Pool 7. And then, as you mentioned, the passing of Bob, never got to see us transition that HD technology over to the Eagles, but that followed later that year.
Yeah, he laid the groundwork. How about a quick update on the Decorah Eagles? July, I guess they're this year's Young of the Year, are flying and fledged from their nest?
Right, yep. So we had D26, D27, and D28 fledged between the 16th and 22nd of June. And they've been flying around. And this year's crew of eaglets fledged has really had a little bit different behavior. They're kind of holding back on learning to fish and take prey on their own. And we've seen a lot more of them because they've been hanging around and crying and begging for fish from mom and dad Decorah. So
yeah,
that's a little bit different than last year, but that's kind of what we've been watching here. And they're still around. We're getting good views of them every day.
Yeah, and a little background. So D28, apparently that's the 28th young in these past decade. So the adults essentially take care of them for the first 11 weeks or so, and then they free fly. But then they kind of oversee the self-sustaining goal of these birds. So they're supplementing these young eaglets at this time?
Right. So they can tear apart prey, and they can mantle it and protect it, and they're even probably, we've seen some of them come in a little bit later than normal, but they're actually trailing and following mom and dad Decorah when they're diving in to grab a trout out of the overflow retention pond here at the fish hatchery. We've also seen them up at the top of the bluff, and that's kind of been a food drop area in the last week or two, where mom and dad have dropped a fish up there, and the eaglets have been hanging out up on top of the bluff in the valley here. So
okay.
We say that they're kind of out on hunting trips, and that's really the time. This is the time where they're watching mom and dad. Mom and dad are kind of luring them around with food and either withholding it or taking it further and further and getting them trained to try to grab it and catch it on their own.
Yeah, this is quite fascinating to see the insights. I might let the listeners soak in that there's over 400 other nesting pairs of bald eagles here in Ames. We've got a couple pairs right here on the Skunk River, two downstream and one at, up by Story City. So that's, and those birds are fledging now this time of year. So that's pretty exciting.
Right.
You know, it's pretty hot, but it's, things are heating up for this year's Young of the Year of bald eagles. But what really created the necessity to make this call, I understand there's going to be a scholarship that'll be dedicated to Bob Anderson's work. Could you tell us a little about that, this new wrinkle to Bob's outreach?
Yeah, definitely, Pat. So initially on, I've been talking with the board, and we had some folks, Susie Nels and others, daughter of Joe Hickey, who you probably know that name through,
sure,
through conservancy and research, just kind of help us steer us in the right direction, if you want to say it that way, to, hey, there's some neat things out there that you guys can do with endowments and setting things up where anyone who wants to be charitable and give towards an effort. We've been talking about wanting to put something together in Bob's name, just with all the people that he attracted and just the gregarious nature that he had with bringing people into his falcon research and then also the Decorah Eagles and working with classrooms and everything. We thought that would be the perfect thing to do, is set up an endowment fund for scholarship. And the board talked about it. We looked at things through the Northeast Iowa Community Foundation, which had the mechanism and has done that for many other organizations to set up funding mechanisms like that. So we did that, and we thought it'd be a great marriage with Luther College. They're local here in town, and
sure,
right in Decorah, Iowa. And there's been some students in the past that have done some video projects, one called Our Eagles, which I know had some awards that came out of that. And you know, just, and we know some of the local professors, and Dave Kester was connected with Emily Neal and some people in that program, and we just thought it'd be a great way to try to help, you know, get some scholarship funding out there to keep students in the area, maybe learning about eagles. You know, we kind of categorized it that we want it to be some kind of environmental stewardship type activity through the programs that are offered at Luther College.
Yeah, this is fantastic. So anybody in our listening area can learn from this and maybe set some goals and have some priorities to how would a family apply for a scholarship in Bob Anderson's name?
This would be something that would come out through a student that would be at Luther College, and there would be a application process that's in the process of being set up right now. And I think, as I mentioned here, you know, we're looking at the criteria that we're looking at for Luther College students in general would be those who demonstrate a concern for the environment, positive environmental activism, or community involvement. So we're looking at somebody with those general, you know, that's what they're looking at trying to do, or that's what they have been doing. So that application will probably come out in the next year here. We'll see how fast we get up. We've got a minimum criteria of $25,000 to start off the fund, and then that fund is managed by the Community Foundation, and then the profits of that fund, which are typically anywhere between like 4 to 5% per year, will be harvested off to fund that scholarship each year. So once we meet that initial criteria, then we'll be able to start offering the scholarships.
Yeah, so I should back up a little bit. Let's make an appeal to our listeners, to anybody that wants to further the bald eagle and environmental pursuits that Bob Anderson promoted so well. We'll get that endowment built up, and then students will be able to apply and further their interest in environmental education.
Right.
Well, this is just fantastic. This is something that I'm sure everybody that had the opportunity to work with Bob Anderson realized his outreach. And this is truly something for the future that is a shining example of the philosophy of the Raptor Resource Project. You mentioned your directors. Let's go ahead and list those individuals. They're always kind of involved with Bob's work. But you mentioned Dave Kester.
Right. And he was involved early on with Bob and the repopulation to the River Bluff area with the Hanging Rock release there.
And yeah. And he's picked up a new nickname. We call him Rock Hawk. For the interest of those cliff nesting peregrine falcons, people call the falcons Rock Hawks when they're in the cliff. So why not call Dave Kester that?
Right.
Okay.
Of him over this season of rappelling and banding falcons, and our nickname was Super Crazy Dave.
Okay. Well, how about the Reddigs?
Yep, so we've got Neil Reddig, cinematographer, Emmy Award-winning over the years here, and just some amazing movie work that he's done, along with our other board member, his wife, Laura Johnson.
Yes.
And so I think we mentioned Neil and Laura, and then we also have Randy Christman, another falconer friend of Bob's. We've got David Lynch, who's out in Massachusetts and is friended Bob and became an eagleholic in the early days. John Dingley, who was one of the founding board members and members of the Raptor Resource Project, and he goes way back.
Yeah, John Dingley, one of the originals, I think probably the first board member.
Definitely. Yeah. And then Brett Mandernack, he and his wife Carol are down in Eagle Valley, Glen Haven, Wisconsin area, and he manages the Kohler Family Preserve there, Eagle Valley, and does a lot of eagle research studies.
Yeah, he put the transmitters on the young eagles that then migrated for the summer up to the Hudson Bay.
Right, all the way up to Kohler.
So he's probably he has a lot of field experience, Brett Mandernack.
And then last but not least, our other two board members, Ken Mueller, who is was a good friend of Bob's through Xcel Energy and was very active with the power plant program that was done through Xcel. And so Ken, and then also another fellow Falconer, Jim Robison, who's down in Illinois. And he's currently raising falcons for falconers and is an amazing wood carver and artist, too. So that's pretty much our board right now.
Well, and see, I wanted to establish you're more than just a director of a raptor resource project. You're overseeing a dedicated and conscientious group of individuals that are now banding together to assist some young, up-and-coming environmental outreach individual that wants to do more for life here in the Midwest and particularly in Northeast Iowa. So that group can really almost become the multiplier effect of what's being proposed here. And I feel, you know, Bob, it just had that vigilant, diligent attitude that things would succeed in the end with his persistence. So this is pretty exciting. And I really want to commend you for getting this ball rolling, so to speak. Is there anything?
Oh, thanks.
Is there a message then you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I guess I'm amazed at just the number of hours and the number of years that we've got watching, you know, this pair of eagles here by the fish hatchery, and then we've got 2 years under our belt with a different pair of eagles to the north, interesting different dynamics. And the thing that really exposes, I think, is the differences between geography and food sources and things like that. We've got lots of video available for young students or researchers, anyone who wants to take a look at that video. It's out there for anybody to take a look at. And we're still learning things. One of the things that I think is really cool, and I know you've asked this question before, is what have you guys learned? And one of the things that we've seen up at the North Nest is the first that we've heard of where the eagle female up there is actually rolling the eggs with her talons. Typically they're...
Oh, rather than her beak.
Right. Instead of pulling it forward with her beak and moving them around, she's actually reaching out and gently, grabbing those eggs with her talons and her and rolling them in that way also, which is amazing when you think about it. The power of those talons and those sharp talons. It's just amazing to see them doing something like that. So we're still learning stuff, about eagle behavior and just the details by watching this day in and day out.
So
I guess the thing that I'd like to leave the message about is we are still learning, and it's just such an amazing thing to be able to look at and really kind of get grounded and connect with nature. And the bald eagle, or whether it be the peregrine falcon with falcon cams, the cam over at Great Spirit Bluff and others, it's just a unique opportunity to get people jumpstart to get outdoors if they are mobile and can make it, or even just get reconnected with nature if they cannot do that. You know, the people who are in either a nursing home or hospital, it's something that we really need, you know, for our well-being, I think, is to be connected with nature.
Yeah, and you do it so well, and thanks for all your technology that you've provided the Raptor Resource Project, now in a leadership role, just a great opportunity to get an update from your Decora Eagle Cam and all the good things that the Raptor Resource Project is providing. Thank you. Thank you, John Howe.
Thank you, Pat.
On KHOI Community Radio, and I've been your host, Pat Schlarbaum, together today with Maggie Westfold and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. We just heard from John Howe, the director of the Raptor Resource Project. Earlier on the show, we heard from Mike Owen and Kurt Johnson, owner of the Slim's Country Market in Story City.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Additional music you heard was Hummingbird by Seals and Croft and Blue and Green by Miles Davis.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.